ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan for your Monday. My name's Corbin Middlemass. I'm in Melbourne. Ed Cowan is in the Harbour City. Hello, Teddy.
Corb, how are you?
I'm very well. How's your fortnight away been? It's lovely to be back chatting cricket with you.
Yeah, it's nice to dip in and out this time of year, I'm not going to lie. Cricket takes up so much mental energy on so many different vectors during the summer. It's kind of nice to dip in and out at this time. I'm not going to lie on that, but enjoyed your interview last week. That was a big fish, Corb.
The chief executive of Australian Cricket, if you haven't heard it, of course you can find it here in the podcast store. Perhaps you can go back and listen to that and then catch up with what we're about to discuss here, which are obviously a couple of the key takeaways from it. What jumped out through your listening device and into that sharp brain of yours that you picked up from the CEO?
I thought it was an entertaining listen, and Todd is very polished when he discusses all things cricket, and he's a great communicator on various levels. I thought you did a good job. I thought you pushed in places that other people probably hadn't. And good on Todd for coming on and happy to be prodded. So a couple of themes that kind of, when I was listening, I was jotting down that I thought you could have maybe pushed further on. So maybe rather mm-hmm. than reactions, but a bit of Corbin feedback. I don't think every dollar is the same. And what I mean by that is, when Todd was talking about private capital and the benefits of private capital, there are three kind of buckets, aren't there, and that we consistently talk to, and that is one of which is IPL ownership, one of which is traditional private equity, so call it Sixth Street or CVC, or there's a whole range of people that invest in sport out of sports funds, and the other is high net worth individuals, either based in Australia, pick your billionaire Twiggy Forrest for instance, or pick your Indian billionaire who loves cricket, who's investing in other teams around the world or not, or missed out, etc. But they all kind of got lumped in together, but I don't think it was necessarily discussed individually, because in my mind, an IPL team owning the Melbourne Renegades is very different to wealthy Melbourne businessman who loves cricket, whose kids play cricket, who wants to support the cricket ecosystem. And so lumping them all in together, I don't think is a fair conversation or a fair comparison.
Mm-hmm. Cricket Australia say they want a blend of owners. I don't think they all want entirely IPL owners. They don't want entirely owners that you're speaking about. You're essentially saying you would load the deck the other way. You would essentially not necessarily... It feels like they want some kind of partnership with the IPL and the IPL teams, whereas you're essentially saying you'd freeze them out, you'd go in other directions.
Well, I would have an open conversation. I just think it's too easy to squirm out of the conversation by saying the advantage of private capital are X, Y, and Z,
yep.
and not really be forthcoming with the variations between the three, because, Todd talked to data advantages and, expertise in running businesses. Well, that's private equity. That's not IPL ownership, because we know that some IPL owners come to Australian states to ask them to help them run their teams. So there's no expertise in running cricket programs. Some of the IPL owners are infrastructure investors. They know very little about cricket. And so there needs to be some delineation, because the strategic overlay is very different between the two, and they have very different outcomes. And so I'm not necessarily saying one is better than the other, although my personal view is if you have too many IPL owners in the Big Bash, there is some kind of sovereign or risk to the pathway that you're providing from a strategic point of view. So I thought you could have, coming back to my original point, just pushed back and teased that a little bit out of him, because it's an easy squirm.
Yeah.
Because at the other end, a Twiggy Forrest who just wants to own the asset for 20 years and support cricket, that could be a great owner of a Big Bash team.
Yeah.
That might fulfill all the things that cricket want. And that's been the joy of the NFL model, as you know.
Mm.
But there aren't many of the other examples. And, a quick question of what are the IPL teams you admire and why? Why do we want them owning our team? And actually being able to tease out what those perceived strategic advantages are that I'm yet to be convinced on.
The problem with not having an IPL owner, though, you could say there's zero IPL owners in the league, is essentially then they're not fearful of that window, or they don't feel like it cannibalizes their product. So what's to say them in future extending the IPL during that window or whatever it turns out to be? And then you've got the same problem you've always had if you haven't got any representation from the IPL whatsoever.
So I totally agree with that as a view. It's a question of in what proportion to the other mm-hmm. team. And so the conversation that you were...
What's the right balance then? So it's eight teams. How many should be IPL owners?
As a starting point, you're kind of pushing me into a corner that I don't necessarily agree with to start with. So I'll just be clear on that. But if all eight teams were for sale, which they're not, you would probably say two. I think Cricket Australia would probably say four. So, you know, but this is, I mean, my preference would be somewhere between zero and two, but eight teams aren't for sale.
Yep.
And so the model that a lot of the conversation was predicated on last week was, three teams were now going to test the market. I don't know if that's true or not. But okay, the working assumption is now three. How many of the three would you see go to IPL teams? I'd say it would have to be a maximum of one. And maybe that's a nice dip in the water to see how they behave and what the governance models can be. And I don't really know because I've got no information on how that's playing out. But I think being more explicit around that rather than we'll work it out, we'll tell you later, it just felt it's a bit of an easy you can wrap the argument in a little bit of bubble wrap and protect yourself a little bit by kind of lumping it all in together.
Yeah. He did say that in the coming sort of days and weeks ahead that they're going to be a little bit better on detail, and I think he admitted that that's something they haven't done as well so far about trying to communicate it with the general public. It does feel like it all comes back to that sort of, and I mentioned this during the interview, it's almost like a religious versus a scientific sort of premise as to, that they believe this is going to happen. There's not a whole lot of science or anything that is around it. So it sort of feels like there's two very different arguments here about whether we're better off having the money up front, whether we're better having the money down the track. So for people that are anti-privatization, this model, it's let's get everything else in order and then maximize the profits when we sell the teams inevitably in the future. And the other side of the argument is let's use the capital now to make it big and great. And it feels like whatever side of the fence you're on, it feels like there's very few people jumping from one side to the other. Is that fair to say that feels like the pretty clear divide and line down the middle?
So I think it's a little blurrier than that, in that many people, were talking to what was presented to them, were a no, knowing that it would potentially pop up in the future. That they might not be anti-privatisation, so to speak. They were anti what was put forward to them. And so, with more information, more time, more understanding, more push on running a better business, maybe you don't have to sell, but maybe you do. But why is now the right time? And so being convinced of that is, I think, where the people that you're probably saying are in the scientific camp need a little bit, they need a little bit more understanding as to what that actually looks like.
So part of the answer I got from that was essentially around this Champions League Grand Slam of cricket, which I know has been spoken about a bit around Cricket Australia. And Todd essentially said, look, in positions like mine, you got to understand we're having conversations with owners of the other leagues, with the ICC, and that this conversation is moving quickly. Went on to say, look, we're a small country on a global stage. Changes on the horizon. So clearly they feel like if they don't get their league in order to some way, shape or form, that they're going to be left out of whatever is a Champions League of T20 cricket on a global scale.
Yeah, aren't they mutually exclusive? So we're not a small country on a global scale. We're the second most important cricket country in the world. Full stop, from a player production point of view, from how global rights are monetized. So I don't believe that to be true. And you can still be involved in the Champions League of T20 and that league simply by having a better league and but that doesn't mean privatization's the answer. Again, so we're conflating arguments. So everyone agrees that the Big Bash should be invested in. Everyone agrees that the best players should be paid more, that there should be a window, that our best Australian players should be encouraged to do that. And I know we'll probably end up talking about the developments through the week around that conversation. So they're not exclusive conversations. It's just that they leap to, we need private capital, and other people are saying, hang on, that isn't always the answer that has to be accepted. You know, let's tease out these other options first.
It would be unusual, wouldn't it, that the ICC would say, hey, unless the teams are privately funded, you're not welcome to the Champions League.
Well, make no mistake, this is why the ICC are totally irrelevant in that conversation. In franchise-based, they're becoming less relevant by the second in world cricket. They simply put on World Cups.
Yeah. Cricket Australia say that they're actively looking at a hybrid model. Give me the pros and cons here. How is this possibly going to look? I feel like out of all three options, so one is fully privatised, the other is no privatisation. This feels like, just as an average cricket fan, my least favourite option out of the three, that some are privatised and some aren't. What are the pros and cons? Set it up for me, Teddy, of what a hybrid model would look like.
Well, I don't know exactly what they're... So let's talk in generalities. Look, what are the pros? Toe in the water. See, there's a way that you can raise some money to fund whatever you wish while, really maintaining control over, 6 of 8 teams, let's call it. I don't know where you kind of get to, whether hybrid is 3, whether it's 1, but somewhere in the mix, let's pick 2. So you can kind of understand what this public-private model looks like for a couple of years. And if it works, well, fantastic. If it's a bad outcome, you've limited your damage. And, if it's middling, at least you can know what your issues are to work through to if you need to privatise further down, or conversely to fix your big bash to make it a better product, as a standalone entity. It allows you to set your governance structures up. It allows you to work through a whole range of things with what I would think is limited downside. So they're the pros. The cons, and I'm sure, this is kind of what you picked up on, what happens if it actually does, I say limited downside, but let's say an IPL team does own a team and they break the salary cap and you force them to sell and there is a real Barney over something. What happens then? So at least it's contained, but it's less of an issue if you've got 8, but at the same time, you might have a problem. You might have one problem child that, really causes the narrative to actually distract you away from the main game, which is cricket.
If you reckon the 6 states are hard to try and wrangle together, imagine trying to chuck in a few private owners and then trying to deal with them as well. While you've got also the 6 states, or say there's however many of them are left at that particular stage or whatever.
But again, it depends on what the ownership structure is. And so you get yourself tangled up potentially into, a PE fund that is a forced seller, for instance, a 5-year, they need to return capital after 5 years and have to sell. And then who do they sell to? And do you get rights into that? Or an IPL owner who then does something ridiculous that you don't agree with? There's an issue around salary caps and how players are compensated between different clubs. So again, the three kind of pools of capital are very different as opposed to someone who just wants to be a passive, very supportive shareholder that can ride the storm with you. What were your reflections? I mean, I will kind of down a bit of a rabbit hole here. You were asking the questions.
Clearly, I mean, just as much as people that are passionate on the other side, they're extremely certain that this is the way to go. I feel like they're not being completely transparent with us, with all the things that they know behind the scenes. And I get part of that is that's every organisation. You can't just completely say, hey, by the way, here's all it is. But I feel like the releasing the BCG report would have been really beneficial to them to try and win the public argument at the start. And they're saying, hey, there's some confidential numbers. Well, you can redact stuff, can't you? Like put big black lines through it and put the thing out there at least so you're starting to win that public debate early on. I feel like they're losing that significantly. And even though they've got, it's seemingly got the voice of a couple of key journos, and you can see that there's, some reports coming out and everything else, and that they're still very much dressed up as, this may happen. This could possibly be what happens next. It feels like there's very little concrete. What Cricket Australia would actually benefit from at the moment is an example. They would benefit from somebody turning their back on their Cricket Australia contract and going to play in one of these franchise leagues, and yet We haven't got anything like that. We've got some, you know, possibly it will happen or it may happen here or there. And you read through the comment section and it's all one way. Don't want it, hate it, you know, stop trying to sell the teams, whatever it turns out to be. So it sort of feels like that feedback is, you know, 95.5 in the comment sections when it comes to the general public. And that they do need to sell to those people. I feel like you and I are more on board than a lot of people in the comment section, judging by the tone of it. So, like, I appreciate that there's been a whole lot of work done into it, but I feel like they need to do a little more, I think, to sell it to the average person as to why it's so important. Not just that it's a good idea, but that it happens today.
Now, I think that's a good articulation. Mm-hmm. It was touched on last week, but the player payment model and how fit for purpose it is. You know, it's interesting to hear Todd say it's not fit for purpose, and yet it's a new deal that was only recently signed, and
he signed it.
So, understanding that, and you know, I keep saying you don't want to pour a lot of money or water into a leaky funnel. And at the moment, it's a very leaky funnel, as you kind of talk to these conversations around, you know, the incentive for players to leave to go in the SAT20, and you know, I don't understand why a player won't put their name to that. Is it because? I mean, I understand because it's a unionized setup in Australia, and so you can't break ranks, and yet you want the benefits of a free market. What frustrates me is when we start getting these anonymous, you know, and there was a little pot shot to this podcast, you know, I think last Sunday around the players are unhappy with some of the comments. It's like, okay, come and explain. We are very curious people. We're very open-minded. We would love to hear from a specific player what is happening, and come and educate us, because in my view, I think it is a furphy, but I keep hearing that it's not. Okay, well, let's hear more about that. And then when someone does call it out, you have Pat Cummins come and refute that publicly.
What do you make of that, by the way? So this was Dan Bredig's article where Bredig wrote, Australia's best cricketers may quit the home summer to play in the SA20 in January 2028. Unless they can be paid more. As part of the article, it mentioned that he'd turned down a signing fee of $800,000 in the 100, and that he, among you know, various other players, were potentially looking at NOCs as early as the 2028 season. Cummins replied on X, basically saying, everything you've written about me in this SA20 NOC and the 100 offer is made up.
There we go. So all these players, I mean, you can only take Pat as his own words to be true. And so there's lots of planting and lots of discussions and lots of managers involved planting things.
The players are a fascinating watch in all this, aren't they? Because
they are the biggest watch here.
There's movement at the station behind the scenes, clearly, and they're unhappy. I think we can take that on face value about how much they're getting paid. And yet, as you say, no one wants to put their name to it. No one wants to be, you know, the bad guy in the eyes of the general public and turning their back on Australian cricket or however it's going to be perceived. It feels like that's a real sore point with the players, that they're worried about how they're going to be perceived if they decided to take that route.
But it is a free market now. And so by all means, if you wanted to do that, and you feel as though that's how you, if your desire is to maximize your earnings, if that is what drives you, money is your main motivator, maybe you're better off, maybe you're not. Go test the market, by all means. But if you want to play test cricket, if you want to be admired, if you know, there are different motivators for different people. And playing in the SAT20 and the ILT10 and whatever, no one cares. You know, maybe locally they do, but no one in Australia cares or follows, or and so it's really up to them. And so,
but the players want both, don't they? Like
you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah. So and this is where you look. DFL Brevis has quoted a lot about his $1 million contract in the SA20. I don't reckon anyone's trading their national contract with DFL Brevis, are they?
There we go. So that, I mean, great pushback. So no national contract, basically, like the equivalent of a domestic player, gets $1 million to play in the T20 league. So he's probably still unders for what an average national contracted player earns in Australia. I don't know exactly, but that's fair. And okay, let's say if he didn't take that national contract, have you watched his IPL this year? He's averaging 16, can't buy a run. So where does he go back to learn his craft if he's, you know, he has to keep, he's on that T20 treadmill? The other example that comes to mind, I was just reading an article on Spencer Johnson, played overnight in the IPL,
mm-hmm.
did quite well. All the quotes around, geez, it's been great to work with Ryan Harris on my bowling action, you know, getting fit, getting strong, making sure I don't get injured. He's the state coach.
Yep.
So you give that up, Spencer. You say, I want to play in these T20 league. You don't get Ryan Harris's technical advice. You're out on your own, mate. And so that's fine too, if you want it. But just be know what is on the other side for that. You can't have maximum payment, maximum flexibility, and also want the security.
Yep. And this is where no one's trading the ACA for any other union around the world, are they? Like, what union when it comes to the IPL or any of these type of leagues? And we talk about, you know, the fat middle class that's in Australian cricket. You know, that the players fought for that for a long period of time, and that's very admirable. But essentially, if you want to tear all that up or change that or whatever, you can't have everything. Something's got to give on the way through.
And the ACA has done an amazing job. And the reason why Australian cricket is so healthy from a player pipeline point of view is exactly that. But you then can't say we want to be paid more, because unfortunately the financial system is broken in cricket. And so, yes, the best players probably deserve more, but there is... No, and not necessarily the middle class. I'd call it the tail, you know, the bottom 25 players that will never play for Australia and are kind of filling in numbers. They are impacting the conversation, given the very nature of how the members of the ACA is set up.
We caught wind that the BBL draft is going to be scrapped for the internationals or the overseas players. Todd refuted that last week, said, look, that's not his understanding, at least at this stage, but they're looking at a whole lot of different options. Surely the easiest answer in the short term to fix up the salary and the pay discrepancy when it comes in the Big Bash is almost, you know, everybody's off contract. Everyone goes into one giant auction the same way they do in the IPL. You can pay the big guys, the big players as much as you want to pay them, and then the system trickles down from there. Isn't that a good way of resetting the pay structure overnight?
There we go. Great suggestion, Corbin. Maybe you should go to the Cricket Australia symposium on ideas as to how to reset the Big Bash, because then you do get exactly that. You get the open free market dictating price. So, and there are some winners and there are some losers. And you get the safety net of, you know, state contracts and national contracts, but specifically for the Big Bash, you'd find a few people disgruntled, probably mainly the people that are trying to lump in their contracts between...
With the state and the franchise. Correct. The four states in particular that we're looking at there, you know, would know all about that. But this is what it was sold to me originally. Like, as a young kid that used to run around going to watch the Western Warriors play at the Wacker, and, you know, when I saw, you know, my beloved cricket team that I followed my whole life disappear, it was sold to me that this was a franchise league and, you know, anyone could play for anyone and, you know, your favourite player from WA might be, you know, in Sydney and so on and so forth. It's basically just turned into like a glorified state league where, you know, barring a couple of players here or there, generally, the Victorian guys playing Victoria and the, you know, Sydney guys playing Sydney and so on and so forth. Like, that was how this comp was imagined once upon a time, that players could end up in different ports around the country. And yes, it's awkward. You got to be away from family during the Christmas period. But like the Mad Men line, you know, that's what the money's for. That the whole idea is that it's meant to be, you know, a franchise league and players can go anywhere. If we get back to what the idea of the original competition was, maybe we'd be in a better place overnight.
Nice commentary.
Anyway, a couple off the email, which we love, by the way. The ABC Cricket Podcast at abc.net.au. That's ABC Cricket Podcast at abc.net.au. From JB, who's in the central west of New South Wales, he said, I really enjoyed the interview with Todd. Actually, to tell you the truth, I hated it. Corbin, you asked good questions. Todd managed to not answer the most difficult. Dan from WA says, long-time listener, loved listening to the Todd interview. He liked Corbin's questions and thought Todd's response responded well. Even if he didn't agree with everything he had to say, he was puzzled by the Grand Slam idea. How would it work with players crossing over between teams? And where would it fit in? Would the ICC be a backer of it? So about a potential, you know, Champions League, you have these, you know, banner T20 tournaments, the IPL, the 100, the Big Bash, hopefully, to be able to have their own window. And then you'd have a Champions League like once upon a time. And I imagine what would happen, Teddy, like it did back then, the IPL teams would get first choice of players.
They get first dibs, for sure, and then have to financially compensate the other teams, which should happen to some degree anyway, but that's a secondary conversation. So, yeah, I think the window probably is September, October, realistically. Mm-hmm. But you can have it all said and done in 3 weeks. I don't understand why you can't do it now? Like, why does it need to be the big four? Why can't you just lump in how they used to, and you have the winner of New Zealand and the MLC and South Africa and Australia and the 100? Well, mainly because the IPL is owners of four of those teams, and it would get messy, but you could try.
Keep your emails coming. We'll have a couple more by the end of the show. The Aussie white ball teams have been picked for the highly anticipated upcoming bilateral series. There's going to be six ODI games, Teddy, which I know you're hanging out for later this month into June. So we play Pakistan in three, then we play Bangladesh in three more, and then there's three T20s against Bangladesh, which are all of a sudden a little interesting given the qualification for the Olympics, which is going to be decided at some mysterious date in the future that no one's able to locate on the calendar. First of all, on the ODI squad that was announced, Ollie Peake's the headline name here, so he's on track to become our youngest specialist batsman in ODI history. And you think about the rich history of Australian cricket, so younger than Ponting, Steve Waugh, Steve Smith, who are all 20 years of age. He'll still be a teenager by the time that that three-game series concludes, if he gets a game in that particular time, Ollie Peake over in Pakistan. What do you make of that?
Roll him out. And this group of selectors, actually, often we talk to hanging on to players too long. They have a decent track record of uncovering new talent, and that new talent kickstarting careers pretty well. And, you know, you can point to Cooper Connolly in recent times, you know, Sam Constance against India. That they see talent, this group of selectors, and they are finding opportunities for them, and there's no better opportunity to blood talent than a white ball series in June against Pakistan or Bangladesh. So I'm all for it. This kid can play. Let's see what he's made of. Get him in there. Let's hope he does well.
Three spinners, Kuhneman, Tanvir Sanger and Adam Zampa. No real surprises there. So that's that the first three games, May 30, June 2, June 4. So there is a little bit of an overlap there with the back end of the IPL, which means that the three-game leg for Bangladesh, Peake's not part of that, but Cooper Connolly comes back in, Marsh and Green and Head all part of it, along with Manus Labuschagne, who's got his spot in both of those ODI teams. Liam Scott is a new name here, so he's going to feature in both the ODI series. And then the same thing, three spinners, Bartlett, Dorshus, Ellis, a couple of those coming back from the IPL is the squad for the three ODIs against Bangladesh. What do you make of Liam Scott's inclusion?
Well, domestic player of the year. Oh, I mean, I probably think his red ball cricket's probably his best format, but, you know, pretty handy white ball player, bats, bowls, fields, great inclusion, I guess. It's nice to see players get rewarded for doing well in domestic cricket, and the last 2 years he's been probably the pick of them.
And then the three T20s against Bangladesh to finish. So this is now mid to late June. The interesting name here is Joel Davies, who, of course, you watch incredibly closely out of New South Wales. Aaron Hardy's also part of the squad. Renshaw's part of all three, by the way. Phillip, he's there as the backup keeper to Inglis. And then the four quicks, Bartlett, Ellis, Johnson, back in an Australian squad. As you mentioned, his performance in the IPL overnight, and Meredith. And then Tanvir Sanger drops out for the T20s. So just Kuhneman and Zampa with the slow bowling options. And Cooper Connolly, who's just had a breakout tournament, is part of that squad too.
So, I mean, I like this kind of squad approach, particularly in the off-season. You can get a look at different people in different conditions. And it also incentivizes, you know, this conversation around players and you know, signing as T20 mercenaries. You're kind of happy, I think, if a Stoinis or a Zampa or people who've had these great careers want to do that. What you're probably not happy is if it's a Cooper Connolly or an Ollie Peake or... And so exposing them to what international cricket means emotionally for them early and giving them that exposure of being able to travel around the world under the security protection of the Australian team and how well organised that is and the emotional connection and how proud that their family will be that they're playing for Australia is a great idea in my mind. And so you can give them these little carrots to keep them wanting more to play cricket for Australia. That should be what makes them tick.
You're more open to this bilateral series than I thought you would be. I thought you'd come in full of hostility about bilateral ODIs in the middle of the winter months, but I like it.
Well, to be clear, I'd much prefer bilateral ODIs in the winter months than in the summer months. Yeah. So play as much. I've always said, fulfill as many obligations as you want, but not from October. October to mid-February. Let's be very focused as to what we can provide the the Australian content, unless it's England or India playing very short white ball to kick off an Aussie summer. That's where I kind of draw the line.
Premium cricket in the summer months. Speaking of squads, we got a bit more on this front. Australia's named a 15-player squad for the ICC Women's T20 World Cup, which will be hosted in England and Wales, June, July 2026, so not too far away now. Sophie Molyneux is again the captain. The vice-captains are Ash Gardner and Talia McGrath. A couple of interesting names here. Young left-arm quick Lucy Hamilton's in the squad. So that's good news for her. She replaces Darcy Brown, who's not part of this setup, unfortunately. And then all your usual familiar names are all part of it. Anything jump out at you, Teddy, at the Australian squad pick to go to the UK?
I mean, not really. This is a big World Cup for the Aussie women, having not won anything substantial for some time now, despite being so dominant. Sean Flegler's comments are around Alana King probably being the fourth pick spinner. That caught me off guard. Obviously, the captain now has to be picked. And so, you know, in T20 cricket, is that her best format? Is she going to be fit? There's lots of kind of question marks.
It's an awkward conversation now, isn't it? That you've sort of got this specialist captain in your lineup that Soph plays, and then you've got to try and pick a balanced team around her. She features as a batter in an earlier game. Not that she's an accomplished batter, but hasn't previously been looked at in that role recently.
I think Talia McGrath's the best T20 captain, I think. I think in tests and 50 over cricket, she's kind of slid down the pecking order a little bit as to how she fits in the team. But
she hasn't been playing well either.
That's true.
Yeah, but this is the problem. The leaders that are looking at, their form hasn't been great, with the exception of Ash Gardner, who's been a premier player and played regularly and captains her franchise, but for whatever reason, she's not the captain of the national team. Still on squads, Ollie Robinson's back after his little sojourn down to Australia. He is back in the England Test squad for the first time in 2 years. So due to fitness and attitude issues, he was dropped in early 2024. He's been captain in Sussex. He's in the squad to play against the Kiwis. Can't wait for this. 3 Test matches starts June 4 at Lord's. 3 uncapped players includes Emilio Gay, who is the Durham batter. It was actually approached by the West Indies. He's got sort of family lineage in the Caribbean, and they thought about trying to pinch him, and in the end, England were like, hang on, this guy's born and raised here in the UK, so he's going to play for England. James Roos in the squad, expected to be the reserve batter, and then Sonny Baker's also part of the squad too, the Hampshire fast bowler.
Yeah, I mean, I think the actual part of the headlines here is Marcus North has slipped onto the selection panel.
What do you make of that?
Well, he's been over there a long time now, and, you know, if you were actually... You know, he's almost quasi... I know he played for Australia, he captained WA for a long time. I don't know how his psychology around this would work. He's obviously married to an English lady. They've got English kids. So why not contribute to the ecosystem you're in? Durham faithful, and, you know, we've seen a Durham batter added to the squad automatically, and he's dropped Zach Crawley. So I think it's a shrewd appointment from England cricket. Like, this is a guy who knows cricket inside out, knows what performance looks like, was a great captain, you know, in terms of people you would back to actually bring some cricket sense to how they think about it. And I don't think he necessarily buys into the whole baseball, you know, psychology either, and so maybe you get a little bit more balance there.
Challenge the status quo. It's not a bad idea. Yeah. Particularly given, you know, if Key and McCullum both stay, Stokes stays, which it was unlikely. I think it's a good thing. I mean, I've got to be careful. I upset our selectors by saying, hey, it'd be a good idea to have a fourth voice or whatever. But, I think it's a good idea to have someone at different points of view. And, yeah, at the end of the day, they're still going to have the primary say, aren't they, the other three. But you've just got someone in there to offer some different insights.
Yeah, this is a big series for England, having been embarrassed in Australia. And New Zealand are a pretty good test team. And, you know, there's a world where, you know, their bowlers suit these conditions and their batters find a way. So it's going to be great. There's nothing better than a little bit of peak of winter sitting on the couch watching Test Cricket Lords. I'm excited.
Dean Foxcroft is the new name in the New Zealand squad. So South African born, represented South Africa at underage level. He's been plying his trade in Dunedin, playing for the Otago Volts. So he's a middle-order batsman, bowls a few little offies, so we'll see him. There's actually one test in Ireland for New Zealand before the 3 test matches against New Zealand. So they play the Irish lads May 27 to 30. So nice to see Ireland in a little bit of test cricket.
is excellent. Do you think we'll see Australia play Ireland in a test match before the Ashes next year?
No. Do you?
No.
No. Okay. Let's go to the IPL, the tournament every single year in the cricket world. Mitchell Starc, man of the match performance last night, 4 for 40, which is good going in modern T20 cricket to go at 10 and over. It picked up 3 wickets in 1 over and a big win for the Delhi Capitals. So the Rajasthan Royals falling short of 200, and then Delhi were able to whip them up with 4 balls remaining. The Rajasthan Royals have only played once in 10 days. So weird scheduling where a lot of other teams play multiple games in that time and they're sitting there cooling their heels. And in the other game, the RCB boys, the defending champs, they locked in a top four spot. They're one result going the other way from locking in a top two spot. So, and there's huge advantages that come with being in that that top two finish and the major semi-final or qualifier one, as they call it, given the way the final system's going to unfold. Tim David got a quick fire 28 off just 12 balls, and Josh Hazlewood got out his longtime teammate Marcus Stoinis with a full toss. I don't know if you saw that, LBW. He was a little unhappy about that. Marcus out for 37. Cooper Connolly also made 37 in that same game, and RCB beat the Punjab Kings by 23. Kings have now lost 6 in a row. They got one game remaining. They're on the skids big time, Ricky Ponting's men, so a bit of work to do for Punjab.
Oh, I don't have much, not much to give here. I mean, Mitch Marsh's form's been impressive.
Cooper Connolly, record Cooper most Connolly. Sixes in his maiden IPL campaign. So, little record for him. I've got a couple of themes for you here. So, first of all, Punjab Kings. So, big issue for them. They've only won one of their last 7 games now in Dharamshala. They've got 2 home grounds. Surely that's an issue, isn't it? Where conditions are kind of different, that you play half your games in one venue and then they play half their games in Dharamshala. Surely that's far from ideal as a T20 franchise.
I mean, it is far from ideal. It happens a little bit here. The Sydney Thunder play 2 home games, essentially of 4 or 5 in Canberra.
So you got to be careful what your comments are on this front. But I mean,
I'm just saying, like, ideally, you have 1 wicket, but there are reasons for and against doing it.
Wouldn't you largely, pick a team at the auction that would suit your home conditions? And if your home conditions are slightly different, gee, that makes it hard to try and win enough games to qualify and be part of the business end of the tournament.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, good pickup.
Scheduling's never been part of Indian cricket's strengths, it must be said, over the years. They often hold things off very late, as they've done so here with their finals format. So 1 plays 2 and 3 plays 4. But this year there's going to be an additional venue chucked in. So essentially, qualifier 1 versus 2 is in Dharamshala. And then the eliminator and qualifier 2 are going to be playing New Chandigarh. So basically what that means is if you lose qualifier 1, so you're the second place team, you lose to first, you then have to fly to New Chandigarh to play the second game. And then if you win that, you then fly on to Ahmedabad to play the final at the new Modi Stadium. So you could have 3 different venues in one final series, and you would be playing a team in the final that has won the first one, had a bunch of days off, trained multiple times, and then play again in the final. So that is horrific scheduling for the team that loses that major semi-final.
Hang on. They've locked in venues.
Venues
for all...
locked in. It's not, yeah, they're all predetermined.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they're not big venues.
Like no.
Dharamshala and Chandigarh, they're the 2 smaller venues. That's odd. I'd love to dive into the reasons that comes about with the BCCI one day. You can only imagine. I'm still trying to
get your head around all that. Here's one for you. So, interestingly, the Gujarat Titans are doing things a little bit differently in the way that they've gone about it. So, they've taken, this was last check, 95 wickets in 12 games, right? So, they were, and then the next best was like 19 lower than that. So, that they've taken so far and beyond the most amount of wickets. Who'd have thought taking wickets in cricket leads to good results? And they've won 5 of their last 6 games. Mm-hmm. But in the power play, they've basically gone Mohammad Siraj and Kagiso Rabada. That's it. 6 overs, 3 from either end. Bowl your best bowlers up front. And they're on an absolute heater as a result of it. Are we going to see this more and more in cricket as runs keep getting higher and higher? That instead of basically trying to go at such a ridiculous clip and runs are up in first overs and everything else, let's double down, bowl your best bowlers up front, try and get some wickets there, and if it's unsuccessful, it's going to be bad news regardless.
So I love this tactic, and it was something that caught my – when I was just looking – I mean, I thought I'd do a little bit of prep. I was kind of looking through the leading wicket taker column and their both there. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Why? So I'm glad you flagged this. It's a little bit like when, you know, you're a big follower of US sport.
Mm-hmm.
When was it the Warriors who just shot threes the whole time and they kind of changed the game and, you know, fundamentally changed the tactics around what was best.
Killed the mid-range jumper and,
So it's kind of one of those moments that, you know, we've seen for years. Oh, you just get some cheapo, you try and get some cheap overs in. The stats for many years have said if you lose 3 wickets in the power play, the likelihood of losing the game is, I don't know, pick your number. It's like 70%. Two is still in your favour as a bowling unit. If it's only one, the odds are that the batting team will win the game. And so, you know, with that in mind, they've obviously just leant in and said, let's try and take as many wickets as possible as quickly as we can. And, you know, you're in the most risks have to be taken because of the fielding restrictions. So, yes, they can get away, and often, you know, teams do. But at the same time, you'll create the most opportunities for wickets with fielders inside the ring and catching positions, et cetera, et cetera. So why not bowl your best bowlers for the six?
Yeah.
So it's fundamentally flipped the thinking as to what those first six overs are. Historically, you know, a batting bonanza. Actually, it puts pressure on the opposition and also makes them do something differently. Because if you're an opening batter, you're like, okay, we now know what their tactic is. Do we try and see them out? Do we try and play off their best bowlers? And so even if they're not losing wickets, they're probably restricting them as well. And so I'd probably need some more data around what, you know, the fewer wicket six over stints are. But, or do other teams go, well, bugger it. We're going to try and, if we can take them down with the fielding restrictions, that sets us up best to win the game. So
it's
really interesting tactical kind of nuance.
I hope they win it. I hope they keep going from here. Good job. It's great, as you said, to be able to see, you know, teams doing something a little bit different and bucking the trend. Ashish Nair is their senior coach. I think your man Matthew Hayden's also there as a batting coach with the Gujarat Titans. So good luck to them on the run through the business end of the season. There's about 8 regular season games to go before we reach the finals stage. And then the other one, which ESPN Crick Info did a really good thing on this, I caught it on socials, talking about right arm around the wicket is back in vogue in the death overs. So basically they're a whole lot of data that they've crunched in numbers to sort of show that this is something that, and I think they referenced Dwayne Bravo was the one that was a great exponent at it going back almost 10 years ago now. But particularly against right-handers at the death, right arm coming around the wicket, obviously to try and nail as many Yorkers as possible. What do you make of that, Teddy, about that as a tactic from the right-arm quicks?
Well, it's a great tactic on a few fronts. It's not just about the Yorkers. It's about creating angles and being able to control where, you know, where your fielders can be and where ultimately the hardest places to hit are. So what's the easiest place to hit a six? A step hit in the arc, you know, hitting with the angle. So right arm over the wicket to right-hand batter, you're hitting with the angle over long on, like a baseball swing.
Yep.
So the more angle you create against that, so right arm obviously even more than left arm, to be able to hit the ball deep into the onside, the angulation of where the ball and the bat meet, I mean, you can still do it, but it's a lot harder to actually hit the middle of the bat consistently on that step hit. And so you're now controlling basically one area of the ground that is very hard to hit to, and you can, you know, it gives you more areas to miss on length. So yes, a Yorker is a great ball because it can either fly down to third man or deep point and you've got your fielders there. But conversely, if it's a half volley, it's still very hard to leverage to, you know, the step hit zone. Takes a very good batter to hit it over cover for six. You know, so it's just, it gives you more room for error is what I'm trying to kind of articulate.
Mm. I like it. Yeah, there were just two little things that jumped out at me from the IPL and what we've seen so far as we get towards the end of the regular season. Have you got time for a couple of quick ones from our listeners? A
couple of quick ones, for sure.
Heath loves the pod. He's been listening since the start of 2025. Says he considers himself much more informed as a result. Wants a live show in Adelaide.
Oh, I'd love a live show in Adelaide.
Adelaide's a great spot. We'll put that on the...
Some great little pubs in North Adelaide. I'm always good for Adelaide, Luke, for sure.
Carl in Dublin wants to hear Adam Voges as a special guest on the pod. We'll buy you a Guinness if you ever make it to Dublin, says Carl.
There you go. Live show in Dublin for when Australia play their test match there next year before the Ashes.
I like it. Ashton's from Bustleton. He says, do you think the schedule across the next 18 months is overkill?
Well, overkill in relation to what? I like Australia playing lots of test cricket. So in that sense, it's, you know, and there's some big series. So big Indian series, big England series. You know, if Test cricket's going to survive, it's going to rely on big series like this. So let's get amongst it.
Yep. It's weird, though, that we still have these sort of lulls in the schedule where there's nothing, and then when it's on, it's all on. So it feels like there's nothing now until August, and then when we play Test cricket again, we don't stop playing Test cricket until the following March or whatever it turns out to be. And Connor Blakely, he's a contribution, former AFL footballer with Fremantle, said, enjoyed the chat with Paul Marsh. Took him back to being the head of the Players Association at the AFL and going through those negotiations. Love the pod. Question for Ed. Why don't more players go across to England and play county cricket?
They've changed the... This is an easy answer, but a great question. So historically, it was quite easy to do. And not just county cricket. You know, it's a bit of a rite of passage for your first grade cricketer to go and play for Teddington in the Middlesex League, or, you know, up in Colne in the Lakes District, or, you know, whatever that is. Yep. But they changed the visa requirements, essentially. I think originally around the time that the Colpack came in, and so you have to have played a certain number of credits for your country to have then be eligible for a visa to be able to play county cricket. So it's quite hard. It's quite restrictive. And so you'll see these players who, you know, Sean Abbott, great example, plays a little bit for Australia, has met his credit base, and so, you know, has the opportunity to play county cricket. But what you don't see is, you know, pick Nathan McAndrew.
Yep.
You know, it's a lot harder for, and there are certain thresholds that he can, but it's just a lot harder.
Yeah. Essentially. If you don't have a British passport and you're not a, you know, high-flying Australian cricketer, it's pretty hard to get over there, which hurts the lower grades as well, isn't it? It's really unfortunate for guys that are sort of on the fringe or just getting into domestic cricket. Would it be awesome to see them playing over there? I remember chatting to a cricketer about it back in 2019, something like that, when it first changed. And yeah, it's certainly set back a lot of the hopes of guys in and around that age, hoping to, you know, in their young late teens, early 20s.
But what is good now that we've got more of this kind of squad mentality of white ball cricket that we talked about, then, you know, the opportunity for Ollie Peake to go play county cricket kind of opens up as well. So it's great for your cricket. There's no doubt about that. And if you think about Mark Waugh or Mike Hussey or Matthew Hayden, that, you know, their careers were forged over there in many respects. They learned how to play spin.
Ed Cowan.
So much benefit.
All those guys.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Teddy, that's a solid hit out. When are you coming back full time? Are you going to get back to a regular
June
Monday?
June 15.
Okay. Up until then, just every second week, little drip feeds here and there. It's been a good hit out today, though. We've got put our pound of flesh.
I felt a little off my game. You know, I think the weekly gets the best out of me. But
enjoyed it. Thank you, Teddy. Have a good week off. I'll find someone to chat to next week, and I'll chat
Adam
to
Rogers.
You. Hey, B. I'll chat to you in a fortnight. Appreciate your time.
Later, Corb.